So what is there in you that can answer to this blueness? D.H. Lawrence's question, what is there in you that can answer to this blueness, I take as a reminder to a wake-up call to remember all that is meaningful in the midst of ordinary life. It's hard to be leading the spiritual life in the midst of ordinary life, and I think it's particularly hard in the midst of the secular society in which we live. And I heard the sort of age we're living in at the moment referred to recently as an age of broken images, by which what I understood from that is that we're surrounded by images and symbols, but there's no coherent structure to that. So we don't necessarily know what they mean, or we don't have a connection with them. So I think it's particularly good that for some considerable time on Tuesday nights, we've been looking at symbols and beginning to learn and understand what they mean and begin to sort of devise our own coherent map of Buddhist symbolism and also link it with those symbols out there in our society. So coming back to this line from D.H. Lawrence, what is there in you that can answer to this blueness? I take it as a reminder to recall that the transcendental, that nirvana, exists and that it can permeate my life. The Vajra and the Vajra Bell, they're two very potent symbols from the Vajrayana which can help us in connecting with the blueness, can help us with connecting with what's meaningful for us, connect us with the transcendental. So I'm going to be exploring this evening how these two symbols can help us stay in touch with reality, stay in touch with shunyata. So I'm going to consider the Vajra first of all. And just to say, they're very extremely rich symbols. So really, I'm only kind of scratching the surface of them this evening. So if I refer to things which don't have a lot of meaning for you, just don't worry about it, because I think the Vajra and the Bell are a sort of lifetime exploration. They actually contain all of Buddhism in them. So, you know, it's a huge lifetime's exploration, really. They're an incredibly condensed, rich symbol. So a few years ago, I had the good fortune to be sitting on the terrace of a Tuscan villa, looking out across the valley, watching a summer storm. It wasn't raining where I was, so I could just watch this display of the heavens. And lightning flashed, thunder rumbled, and the curtain of darkness was rent apart and the landscape illuminated and revealed. There's something quite awesome about thunderstorms. They have a tremendous sort of power, and they transform the landscape in which you're in. I mean, sometimes they actually destroy things and transform things in that kind of way. They're quite violent. But they're very powerful and awesome. And Vajra means thunderbolt. In particular, it's associated with the thunderbolt of Indra, who was the Indian king of the gods. So it has parallels with the thunderbolt of Zeus in Greek mythology and the hammer of Thor from the Norse mythology. So one of the main principal meanings of Vajra is as a thunderbolt. But Vajra also means diamond. And the diamond is the hardest of all precious stones, which cuts everything, but nothing can cut it. The diamond is also absolutely pure, absolutely incorruptible, cannot be soiled or stained by anything. So the Vajra combines the attributes of the thunderbolt and the diamond. It's something infinitely powerful, something that smashes through all obstacles, something irresistible and indestructible. And at the same time, it remains absolutely pure under all conditions and in all circumstances. So the Vajra is the diamond thunderbolt, or the thunderbolt diamond. But what does this mean? What does it mean for us to hold a diamond thunderbolt in our hand? Well, the Vajra as diamond, I take to mean the unstained, unblemished, incorruptible aspect of reality, the uncompounded, unchanging, indivisible nature of the enlightened mind. The Buddha once said to his monks, "There exists, monks, that which is unborn, that which is unbecome, that which is uncreated, that which is unconditioned. For if there were not monks, that which is unborn, that which is unbecome, that which is uncreated, that which is unconditioned, there would not be made known here the escape from that which is born, from that which is become, from that which is created, from that which is conditioned." So to realize the diamond aspect of the Vajra, we need to reflect deeply on the nature of conditioned existence. We need to begin to emotionally realize that our views are topsy-turvy. We imagine that the world as we know it is pleasant, permanent, substantial, and beautiful. But in fact, that view, that belief, is from the Buddhist perspective, it's topsy-turvy, it's the wrong way up. Because in fact, conditioned existence is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial. Our cars will rust or go wrong, break down, our children grow up, our partners change. We're always looking for security in the wrong place. And it's only reality, only the unconditioned, only nirvana, that is permanent, pleasant, substantial, beautiful, and to be relied on. So the Vajra as diamond, I think, is telling us to look at how things really are, look at the true nature of conditioned existence. And one of the ways we can do that is by reflecting on the Lakshanas. We only need to choose one because they're all interconnected. So the three Lakshanas are that conditioned existence is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial. And it's very easy for us to, at least on an intellectual level, to say, yes, well, of course, everything's impermanent, and yes, things aren't always very satisfactory, although quite a lot of the time they might be, or might seem to be. So it's easy for us to understand that in an intellectual sense, but it's very difficult to base our lives on the truth that everything is in a state of change. So we need to keep reflecting on that, keep embracing the truth of impermanence, rather than fighting it. And I think we just do that by bearing it in mind and trying to see what's happening as deeply as we can at any sort of moment in time, rather than fighting it and turning away from it, just turning towards it and saying, yes, this is the way things are. Conditioned existence is impermanent. my car, to use a mundane example, ordinary everyday example, will one day give up the ghost. My child will leave home. You know, we're surrounded by change all the time. But I think it's really important not just to reflect on one of the lakshanas, but also to imagine the corresponding gateway to liberation, because each lakshana has its corresponding sort of positive counterpart. And however sort of strange or hard to grasp they might seem, I think it's very important that we try and also imagine what that state of mind might be like. So the corresponding gateway to impermanence is the signlessness or imageless, the gateway of signlessness or imagelessness. So it's a state in which you bypass all words and all thoughts. No words, no concepts apply. It's a bit inconceivable. I mean, I find it is inconceivable. But I think just to try to imagine what that might be like, you know, not to have any words or thoughts and not to have the kind of whole fabric of sort of belief that goes with those is a really important thing to do. It's a positive state because it's a gateway to liberation. So I think it's also important to try and imagine the corresponding gateway. So one of the other lakshanas is that conditioned existence is unsatisfactory, and the gateway that corresponds to that is the unbiased. And if you go through this vimoksha, you're in a state of perfect poise. You're like a perfectly round sphere on a perfectly flat plane with no desire to go in any direction whatsoever. There's no egotistical motive for doing anything or even for not doing anything. It's just like you're in a state of complete poise, and you're not being pulled, or your mind's not even kind of going in any direction. It's a sort of, it's a state of equanimity, but it's poise. You just need to try and kind of bring the words and just imagine what that might be like. We're so kind of all over the place that it's kind of difficult to imagine what it might be like not to have any direction to go in. And mightn't it be really boring anyway if we weren't sort of wanting to go somewhere? So that's the unbiased vimoksha. And the third vimoksha, the third gateway to liberation, is shunyata, which you maybe know a little bit about. That nothing has any inherent self-identity. In a way, everything's transparent. This is the diamond aspect of the Vajra, that it's only the unconditioned, it's only reality, the state of the enlightened mind, that is pure, incorruptible, not changed by anything. And we can approach that. One way we can sort of begin to move in that direction is to reflect on the three lakshanas and their corresponding gateways to liberation. So then we come to the Vajra as thunderbolt. Well, the Vajra as thunderbolt is a symbol for insight, the reality that tears asunder our veil of ignorance and enables us to see things as they really are. It destroys craving and ignorance. Now I tend to think of thunderbolts as destructive, powerful, smashing through, breaking through. But I don't actually think that prajna, transcendental insight, is quite like that. I think it's more like that you have an experience of shattering, an experience of shattering barriers, but that can be a very joyful experience. It can also be, I think, very soft, gentle and delicate. And some of you might know that story from the Crusades, which I learnt in my childhood. Richard the Lionheart goes to meet the Saracen king, or leader of the Saracens, Saladin. And Richard the Lionheart's really keen to prove his prowess with the sword. And, he was a powerful kind of Anglo-Saxon who was very successful in battle. So he called for a huge log and proceeded to chop it in half with a single blow of his sword. So then Saladin just smiled and called for his sword and a piece of silk. And the piece of silk was just tossed in the air, fell on his sword and was split in two. So I think the experience of prajna is a bit more like the silk and the log, that it's a quite gentle but nevertheless shattering experience. So whilst the Vajra is extremely powerful and shatters our delusions, it's not necessarily like a sort of huge demolition ball that comes and kind of crashes you into the ground and kind of leaves you there, all broken up. So how do we approach this, the Vajra as thunderbolt, as reality, as shattering our illusions? Well, I think one way of avoiding this being too abstract is to think about Vajra as simply being what is. The Vajra is just what is. And I mean that quite simply and in an ordinary way, of the Vajra is what is in terms of the facts of what's actually happening. It's whatever is happening right now to you. So there's no sense in denying it. If we look closely at our lives, we tend to find ourselves in a sort of fairly constant or habitual argument with ourselves about what's happened, what went on, what is going on. We've probably all got loads of examples of that this summer of monsoon rain. You know, we don't want it to be raining again. It's spoiling our plans, it's spoiling our summer, it's spoiling our gardens, you know. We just don't want it to be raining. The house may need tidying, but we don't want to do it. So we can go through all sorts of arguments with ourselves about how it's going to get done or whose turn it is or whatever. I do Tai Chi. And there's one exercise we do every week, which I really dislike. So when it comes to that point in the class, I either start to get distracted, I start complaining, I wish I wasn't there, I sort of drag myself through it, the sort of sense of reluctance, I wish that my teacher would just miss it out one week. Sometimes, but not very often, I've tried to make it sort of enjoyable somehow. I think I'm so far down that kind of not liking it that even that's not very satisfactory either. So one day, I realised I was just fueling my resistance by either wishing the exercise away or somehow trying to make my experience better than it was, you know, make it more positive. The fact of the matter is, this exercise happens every week without fail. And interestingly enough, since I've just accepted that it's going to happen and stopped arguing with myself, it's gone a lot better and it's even begun to be enjoyable, occasionally. So, You know, I think we can just approach the Vajra in its thunderbolt aspect as this objective reality, just the facts. And if we really accept the facts, then craving and aversion disappear and we waste no energy. In a way, everything becomes perfect. So a grey, rainy day is a perfectly grey, rainy day. Ego can be defined as the non-acceptance of things as they are. And ceasing to fight objective reality is a movement beyond our ego. So ceasing to fight objective reality is a movement beyond our ego. I think this quality or aspect of the Vajra also links with a quality which we need to develop in Buddhism, which is uju, it's quite a nice word, which means straight, upright, straightforward. It's a key ingredient in Buddhist practice, and it's mentioned at the start of the Karaniya Metta Sutta and in the Tiratnavandana. So someone who wants to practice Metta should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble. That's the second verse of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And it's interesting that this quality of uprightness actually gets emphasized. So we should be aspiring to be not just upright, but perfectly upright. And this quality of straightforwardness means that we do things in a straightforward, open and uncomplicated way. We don't need to resort to anything underhand or devious. You know what you think and you're honest in communicating it without playing games or hiding behind half-truths. So in connection with this quality, Sangharakshita says, if you are watering down the truth of what is really going on, you are watering down your ability to apply the Dharma to your life. If you habitually mask your true feelings out of fear of confronting people with the truth of yourself as you really are, you are hardly likely to be able to confront that truth yourself. You need to be able to see the real danger in being woolly and vague, to see that avoiding the truth of the immediate situation fatally undermines your practice of the Dharma. Being upright in this context involves being clear about your aims and honest about how they are to be achieved. So I think that this aspect of the Vajra is not only about recognizing the objective facts of a situation, it is also about knowing ourselves more and more fully and being able to be just quite straightforward about that. You know, we all have negative mental states, so it's being able to own those in quite a sort of straightforward kind of way as part of our experience at any particular moment in time without undermining ourselves or feeling falsely humble or trying to sort of play games. So that's the Vajra as thunderbolt, or some thoughts about the Vajra as thunderbolt. So the Vajra is a very strong symbol. So the Vajra is also the Buddhist path. The path of Buddhist development. There's a central sphere in the middle, out of which come two lotuses, and then there are five, there's a central axis with four prongs. So you've got this central sphere with five prongs at either end of it. Yeah? So this central sphere represents reality. reality as the ultimate source of the whole of existence, out of which the two poles of the Vajra, these two sets of five spokes, come. So one of these set of spokes represents the five Buddhas with their corresponding five wisdoms of the mandala of the five jhanas. And I'm hoping, I'm thinking that you're all quite relatively familiar with the mandala of the five Buddhas. So anyway, this one set of spokes represents the five Buddhas of the mandala. There's the Moggacitti over there. He's one of them. Then the other set represents the five elements, earth, water, fire, air and space. The five aggregates, or the five skandhas, which are form, feeling, perception, volitions and consciousness. And that's a very important teaching in Buddhism, which you needn't worry about. Yeah, at the moment, I'm just mentioning it. And then these five other five spokes also represent the five poisons, which are infatuation or unawareness, aversion, conceit, passion, and envy. So, when I hold the Vajra, first of all, I touch excellent enlightenment. So you touch, when you hold the Vajra, you touch reality, which I think is a really amazing thing to do. So I'm holding reality, touching reality, and then I see the split into conditioned and unconditioned. Samsara and Nirvana, the everyday world and the spiritual world. But what's really important is that these two sort of worlds, these two great poles of existence, they're not separate, but they've got the sense, they're linked by the central axis which runs through them. And that makes the possibility of transformation. That means that there's the possibility of transformation. So the Vajra represents the path and the fact that we can refine the mundane and transform the five elements into the five Buddhas and the five poisons into the five wisdoms, the five transcendental wisdoms. So it's a symbol that transformation is possible for us. And I think that when we hold a Vajra, you can get a sense that you can do it. You can transform the base metal of your deluded state into the gold of enlightenment. So this is the Vajra, the diamond thunderbolt. It's a symbol of reality and of transformation. I think actually it's, in terms of the sort of theme of this last few months, it's a symbol of both spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Because in order to refine our everyday consciousness, there has to be the sort of, part of that refining and transformation is the death of the ego. And then we also have the transformation into the Buddhas of the mandala. So just briefly, I want to remind you which figures hold the Vajra, which Bodhisattva and Buddha figures hold the Vajra. Because I think it gives us another sort of, take in a way on the Vajra itself. So there's Vajrapani, who has a peaceful and a wrathful form. He's often depicted in his wrathful form, and he's a sort of squat, bulging, dark blue figure who has got great energy and power, and he's trampling greed and ignorance. And he holds the Vajra in his right hand aloft, so he's ready to destroy greed and ignorance. So that's Vajrapani. Then there's Padmasambhava, who Padmavajra introduced us to a few weeks ago. And Padmasambhava is the archetypal guru of transformation. And he holds the Vajra in his right hand. And he's someone who you approach at your peril, because you will be transformed. Those of you who were here last night will remember Acharya's story about his first meditation class that he knew when he went into, got out of his car in Mappin Street, that his life was going to change. Well, it's the same, you know, you approach Padmasambhava at your peril, really. And I always think that lines from Kubla Khan apply very aptly to Padmasambhava. And all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise. So, you beware Padmasambhava and his flashing eyes. And as I say, he holds the Vajra in his right hand. And then there's Akshobhya, who's one of the Buddhas of the Mandala, of the five Buddhas. And he's a dark blue Buddha who holds a Vajra upright in his left hand. And Akshobhya is a very powerful figure who has a sort of great stability. He sits in the earth-touching mudra, and his the corresponding animal is the elephant. So there's a sense of powerfulness, or something. His name means imperturbable. There's something that's kind of unrelenting in a way about Akshobhya. So he's someone else who holds the Vajra. I now want us to look at the Vajra bell. And I'm just going to mention three associations with the Vajra bell. So the Vajra bell, the bell is a wake-up call. It's a reminder to stop, look, listen, to be present, be aware, come back to yourself. And there are some retreats. Thich Nhat Hanh particularly has a mindfulness bell on a lot of his retreats, which rings throughout the day. And it's a reminder to sort of pause, stop, listen, breathe, connect back with yourself. So I take the Vajra bell, first and foremost, it's just a wake-up call. It's a reminder to connect with all that is meaningful and all that is important in my life. So it's a reminder to recall my purpose, and to come back to my continuity of purpose. So it's a sort of memory aid memoir. Well, it's more than that, but it's just a sort of wake-up call, really. I mean, I guess a modern equivalent for some of us might be setting our mobile phones or our computers to beep at certain times, and that would be a sort of modern equivalent of the Vajra bell. Reminder to you to breathe, to connect you with your ultimate purpose in life. a second aspect of the Vajra Bell for me is that it just takes me into the blueness. So following that sound to wherever it goes to sort of takes me away from my kind of ordinary, ordinary kind of thoughts and things, and takes me towards all that is meaningful, takes me towards reality. So I'll ring the bell again, and you can just follow the sound and let it take you wherever it takes you, really. So, you know, I think a bell makes a break between our consciousness where it is and takes us somewhere else. And I think that's probably why we have a bell to start a meditation, is it's like taking you into the possibility of another dimension. Then, finally, the Vajra bell is a symbol of shunyata. It's a symbol of emptiness. So I'm going to read you another quote. The symbolism of the bell is sometimes explained as follows. When a bell is struck, it produces a sound which, like all other phenomena appearing to our senses, seems to be inherently existent. In other words, to an unenlightened being, this sound appears to exist solely from its own side, in its own right, as an independent something out there waiting to be perceived. But when we search to find such an independently existing sound, we cannot find it anywhere. We cannot locate it in the clapper, in the rim of the bell, in our ear, or anywhere else. But although we cannot find it in this way, it still exists. As analysis reveals, sound is a phenomenon that arises totally independent upon the interaction of other phenomena, e.g. the striking of the clapper against the rim. It is a dependent arising, and as such lacks even one atom of inherent self-existence. Sound, therefore, serves as a clear example of a phenomenon that is totally empty of inherent existence, and the bell is used to remind us of the wisdom that directly perceives this emptiness and cuts through our imprisoning ignorance of the way things exist. So I think sound is a very good example of a phenomenon that has no kind of inherent selfhood, and that's what shunyata is all about. So the Vajra Bell represents shunyata, that open dimension of being where everything is in process and ungraspable. I think also the structure of the bell, the sort of open inside, is also an example of this sort of emptiness. So I'll just ring the Vajra Bell again, and you can try to see if you can pin down anything inherent in the sound. You know, where does it come from? How does it arise? Where does it go? So that's the Vajra. That's the bell. They are, as I've said, they're very rich symbols, and there's a lot of detail which I can't go into in this talk. But if you're interested, you can research it for yourselves. I mean, the bell also represents a whole mandala in its own right. And everything on both the Vajra and the bell has a significance. So they repay a lot of study. But they also have a significance when they're brought together. The Vajra and the Vajra bell are used in tantric rituals quite a lot. They are ritual objects. And you always hold the Vajra in your right hand and the Vajra bell in your left. And when they're together, the bell stands for transcendental wisdom and the Vajra stands for compassion expressed as skillful means. When the Bodhisattva sees living beings suffering because of their delusions, he's impelled to act to help the suffering world. And he does this by practicing the perfections, the five perfections, paramitas. So Vajra stands for the development of generosity, ethics, patience, effort, and meditation. But for the perfections to be perfections, they have to be imbued with transcendental wisdom. And the bell represents the wisdom with which the perfections are imbued. We're just coming sort of right back down to earth in terms of skillful means. I thought Amoghavamsa put it very well last night, or very simply and straightforwardly, that you just do whatever needs doing, whether it's washing up or giving a talk or answering the phone or whatever. You just do, or helping somebody who's in trouble. You know, we just do, we're aspiring bodhisattvas, you just do whatever needs doing and go out to help people in a way that's imbued with kindness. So I think kindly action, kindly unselfish action is skillful means. So when you get you put the Vajra and the bell together, you get skillful action and transcendental wisdom. And there are some bodhisattva figures who hold the Vajra and the bell. Next week you're going to be looking at Vajrasattva. So I'm just going to end by introducing you to Vajradhara, who is the bearer of the Vajra. He's the primordial Buddha of the Gelugpa and Kagyupa school of Tibetan Buddhism. And he's seated in meditation on a lotus of multicolored petals. And he's a deep blue in color, like a mound of sapphires. And his arms are crossed at his chest. And in one, he holds the Vajra. And the other, he holds the Vajra bell. And it looks, when you see him in pictures, these aren't quite the same size, looks as though he's holding a double Vajra. Looks like he's just got Vajras because he can't see the bell. But actually, he's holding the Vajra and the bell. So he is a figure of great stillness, great confidence, and great stability. And when you hold the Vajra and bell in this way, it represents the union of opposites. So at the very highest level, wisdom and compassion are seen to be two aspects of one experience, because reality is non-dual. So in the end, we've gone beyond all dualities to become Vajradhara, the bearer of the Vajra, suffused with the power of reality and invested with the diamond thunderbolt.